This is Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. He was known to the world as Dr. Death. His first so-called medicide happened in the Detroit area in 1990. From that point, Michigan pathologist Dr. Jack Kevorkian became the best-known face of the Right to Die movement. He assisted in the suicides of over 100 terminally ill people between 1990 and 1998. Eventually, he was convicted of second-degree murder after personally giving a patient a lethal injection. He served 8 years and then was released after he promised to end his medicide practice. He died in 2011 at age 83. Now Dr. Kevorkian's papers are open to the public at the University of Michigan's Bentley Historical Library. Olga Virakovskaya is the lead archivist for collections management at the Bentley Historical Library. Good to have you with us.
Hello. Thank you for having me.
Tell us how the university came to acquire these papers.
The Bentley Historical Library became interested in the papers of Dr. Kevorkian pretty early on in the mid-1990s. So he was contacted, but it never happened. After his death in 2011, a field archivist contacted his niece, and she was very open to the possibility, and that's how it happened.
So what's actually in the collection? You've been processing these materials for many, many months now. What'd you find?
It's a very diverse collection of papers, just as diverse and interesting as Dr. Kevorkian himself. And it reflects on every interesting aspect of his personality, his interests, and his work. So, for instance, it starts with the papers of his family. He comes from a very interesting family. It's a true American story. His mother, Satinig, I hope I pronounced her name right, was a refugee. She fled the Armenian genocide of 1915, and she witnessed the horrors of it. His father was also Armenian immigrant and a small business owner in Pontiac, Michigan. He had two sisters. One of them, Margot, became his biggest supporter, and people knew her because she always was with him. And his other sister married a German diplomat. So these materials also reflect his personal and professional interests. So there is his music, his sheet music that he wrote.
So he composed.
He was a composer. He was a gifted musician. He also played organ and other instruments. So there are recordings of him playing his music. There are reproductions of his paintings. He was a very interesting artist.
I remember seeing some of those on display in a storefront in Royal Oak, right across from his apartment building. And you're right, some of them one might call ghoulish, macabre.
Well,
some might say interesting is a good word.
I have to say that his music is on the lighter side. Also, this collection includes materials that reflect on his scientific interests. And just to tell everyone, we know him for the medicide. And by the way, I believe that he coined that term. That's what he called physician-assisted suicide. But he was also interested in organ donation and organ transplantation. He had quite a few other scientific interests. While in prison, he created a dental instrument and he patented it.
So the creativity never stopped.
No.
It never stopped. So you have said you don't agree with that popular nickname that the media of the world pretty much applied to him of Dr. Death. Why is that?
Well, first of all, the medicide families didn't call him that. They called him, in some instances, I know for sure, Dr. Life. I mentioned the framed portrait that we have. It was painted in 1993 by a supporter, and it says Dr. Life on it. So he's a controversial figure, and it comes across in the collection.
What most surprised you as you came to know him as best you could by going through his writings and looking at his artwork and listening to the music that he composed and hearing the taped conversations with his clients, with his medicide patients? How did that person differ from the person that most of the world saw in TV newscasts?
There was something about him, I think, that I did not experience myself because I never met him personally. I know that people who met him, especially the medicide families, that's what he called the families, absolutely loved him. There was something about his persona on the personal level that did not come through the TV set did not come through the news clippings. It was personal and made people just love him.
Interesting. Olga Virikhovskaya is lead archivist for collections management at the University of Michigan Bentley Historical Library, where Dr. Jack Kevorkian's papers are now open to the public. Olga, thank you so much for being with us today.
You're welcome. Good to be here.
With us now is the niece of Dr. Jack Kevorkian, Ava Janis. So good to have you with us on the program.
Thank you.
Why did you choose to donate your uncle's papers to the Bentley Historical Library?
First of all, it's uncle's alma mater. It's also mine. I trust them with handling the papers. They're very professional here. And also, I want to perpetuate uncle's ideas. They're very important. Medicide, euthanasia, and prisoner procurement, organ procurement. Mm-hmm. And for those reasons.
I'm wondering, how different, can you give us a sense, was the man you knew as uncle from that image of that Dr. Death nickname that was given to him, the man that people saw on the TV news clips and in the papers?
It wasn't different exactly, Cynthia. Uncle was a very complex man. He could be very, very laid back, which was his natural way. Very personable, had a good sense of humor. He could also speak with tremendous zeal and enthusiasm on something he really believed in, which is the side that most people know him in. You know, as part of it out of necessity. He wanted to stress his point and get his point across to everyone, make sure everyone understood what he was saying.
Do you think he enjoyed the limelight, or did he just deal with it as something that needed to be done to get his message across?
The latter, needed to be done to get his message across. Some people think that he liked the limelight a lot. A lot of limelight was put on him, probably partly because, or mostly because, people like to talk about death. Mm-hmm. It's a scary issue. None of us know what it is, you know. But he knew he had to, and it was his only way to propel or inform everyone what he was offering and the necessity of what he was offering.
And he wasn't above some theatrics. I remember when he showed up in Oakland County Court dressed in a Revolutionary War outfit.
Everyone remembers that, yes, yes. He was trying to do Thomas Jefferson, whom he admired, of course. Again, he was trying to get his point across. I'm sure a lot of people who don't understand him would misinterpret that, of course, but that was yet another way for he to get his point across.
Now, what did the prison time do to him?
Well, I think it wore him out physically. He was already 71 years old when he went in, so he wasn't a young man to start with. Mm-hmm. Even if he had been younger, I was objecting to him going, of course, partly because of his age and mostly because he's not a thug. He doesn't have that mentality to belong there. So even if he were younger had he gone in, it still would have worn him out physically. But he was indeed 71, so he came out more frail.
Yes.
As a result.
Because he was in for
9 years.
9 years. I knew. Not quite the decade, but that's
right.
A long, long time at that mm-hmm. age. I remember your mother, Margot, so often right there by his side. I actually chatted with them both when they were outside the Troy Post Office in 1990. They were collecting signatures for a petition. So it's very clear that you have inherited your mother's and your uncle's feelings about right to die and about medicide, assisted suicide.
Well, thank you very much. I believe in everything Uncle stood for. It makes sense. It's necessary. Whether we want to talk about it or not, it's necessary.
Do we talk about it more because of him?
I believe so. I believe he is directly responsible for people talking about it more, for it coming to the fore, for five states passing, for what it's worth, their own laws about medicide, physician-assisted suicide. Yes, he's directly responsible. He is the pioneer for it, or of it.
There are people who feel devoutly that Jack Kevorkian was a medical ghoul.
Yes.
What do you say to those people?
I say to those people they should put themselves in the shoes of not only my uncle, but the people who were ill. Everyone doesn't want to just sit there and wait till their heart passes out, you know. It depends on how you feel and your state of mind and your own situation. Everybody walks in different shoes. So it's easy to point the finger. And none of us, including the patients that my uncle did do, we don't know what's on, shall we say, the other side. We don't know what death is. But you have to put yourself in their shoes. If they don't want it here anymore, they should be allowed to have that choice. And just because the choice is given doesn't mean everyone's going to opt for it, but it should be there. It relaxed all of Uncle's patients and possible patients, the fact that they had. Uncle interviewed a lot of people. When I say people, a lot of prospective patients.
Yes, yes.
The fact that they had a choice, an option, it calmed them down. And most people didn't take the option, just a handful that did. Yes.
Well, there were many who did not.
Many did not. Hundreds of people. I had interviewed lots and lots of people. They were prospective patients. Either they weren't ready in Uncle's eyes as a physician, but they had it with all the medicines and things they were taking. You
yes.
get impatient, of course, because you're not getting better.
Mm-hmm.
But lots of reasons he said no to them. But they had that option, that this is an option, should it be legal. It was a relief to everybody.
Do any of the writings that have been donated, of his writings, does he explore what he thinks death is, or what are most of his writings about?
He might say a little bit in his mm-hmm. books, for example. A lot of the papers are medical, of course. But he was a philosopher. When you talk about death and things like this in medicine to this extent, you have to sort of be a philosopher and sort of try anyway to think past we here in this life. So yes, you know, either directly in direct sentences or indirectly in the thoughts that he's written down. You just have to. It comes out or up.
What do you think of his artwork?
I like it. I understand it, you see. It's funny, Cynthia, because people will look at something or hear a story or see something on the news, for example. Say they hear a radio story, a news bite on the mm-hmm. news, and everyone interprets things differently. You hear the same story. And, of course, the same thing goes for art, visual, you know, in the sculpture or anything, and especially Uncle's art because it was medical. And he was trying to get a point across, again, in each one of them. And especially being a physician, for example, his painting called Paralysis, the poor guy is literally bent out of shape. I mean, it's uncomfortable. He's trying to get that point across to everyone. It might seem ghoulish, but if you don't feel well, you'll understand it.
Hmm. So much for scholars and for the public to be able to learn about the heart and the mind of your uncle, Dr. Jack Kevorkian.
Yes.
Well, it was a pleasure to meet you. Ava Janis, the niece of Dr. Jack Kevorkian. She recently donated his papers to the University of Michigan Bentley Historical Library. Thank you so much for being with us.
Thank you for inviting me.